Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome to the podcast. I hope you're well. It definitely feels like a bit of spring is in the air at last. I really hope so anyway. Definitely feels like it's getting lighter. It just seems a bit more light everywhere. We've been doing a self-love challenge in the Sober Club this week. I thought leading up to Valentine's Day, rather than all the over-commercialised stuff, we'd focus on self-love. And of course, that's, you know, the first time for many people they've ever considered the concept. So we've made it very accessible and just had lots of inspirational messages and meditations and links to all kinds of content that just gets people thinking, you know, as I say, sometimes for the very first time, thinking about how they can begin to accept themselves, how they can be all of who they are, you know, that lovely phrase, be you. Everyone else is taken, right? And also, a lot of our members have, for the first time, I think, started to recognise the importance of how we speak to ourselves. And that might be out loud. It might just be internal. But we're pretty unkind, I think. I think it's fair to say. Until you stop, until you pause and notice it, we can be really unkind to ourselves. We can say some horrible things. And I think once you can kind of pause and notice that, we can ask, well, is that actually true? And while I'm not saying any of us are perfect, most of the stuff we say to ourselves isn't true. And even if it is, let's have some compassion, right? Just as we would for other people. Most of us are really kind, and we wouldn't say the things we say to ourselves. We wouldn't say them to a friend or to, you know, someone we cared about. We'd find another way of expressing whatever it is we want to say, even if, you know, perhaps even if something tricky has to be said, then, you know, there's always a kinder way, isn't there? I remember that, I'm sure I've said this before, but I remember that saying of, it was Susan Jeffers who, gosh, she was responsible for so many nuggets of wisdom, Susan Jeffers. It's a really old book, isn't it? Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And I don't know if it was in that book or in her next, in one of her other books, End the Struggle and Dance with Life. It might be in that one, where she says, don't be right, be kind. Don't be right, be kind. And wow, that is something, isn't it? I have to catch myself sometimes, particularly with the kids, you know, because I quite like being right. As you can imagine, I like being right. But it's not always important to be right. It's, you know, it's important to be kind. So we've been doing a lot about that self-love challenge. And of course, that brings in kindness to ourselves, random acts of kindness. One of our members just paid for someone else's parking, and, you know, makes a huge difference, puts a smile on everybody's face. You know, as you will be well aware, when you offer someone else an act of kindness, you get more than they do. You know, the giver actually benefits more than the receiver, and that's scientifically proven. We've interviewed Dr. David Hamilton, who's king of all of this, of course, and a scientist, several times, and you know, that's actually scientifically proven. So if you ever want to be kind to someone else, it's altruistic for you. It's going to be really good for you too. So, you know, everybody wins, really. Anyways, we're just finishing up our self-love challenge. There's been some great stuff sent out. If you still want to be part of it, just join us and you'll get access to all the amazing meditations and all the amazing content. I don't think it's ever too late to make a start on this stuff. If you're already seasoned at meditation and self-love and all of that stuff, then, you know, it's interesting to see what the next level is for you. How are you going to level up next? There's always another layer to unwrap, obviously. But for many people, I think when they ditch the booze, it is the time when they start to become aware of something more, you know, something else, whatever that might be for them, something where they can start to look within and they can dig a bit deeper, you know. And of course, obviously, stuff comes up to be addressed, doesn't it? When you're not drinking anymore, you can no longer just numb it all out and go booze. You've got to actually look at some stuff. You've got to find from somewhere that emotional maturity that may not have been there. If you started drinking at 15, God knows you've not really been through anything without a booze haze, pretty much. So it can be a shock to the system. As you know, there are many recommendations for easing that transition and making it a lot smoother for yourself. If you haven't already, do have a look at Happy Healthy Sober, because there are just so many tips and ideas in there that I wish I'd known in those early months. You know, not least the importance of the nutrition and the mindset and how you reduce those cravings and the techniques and the tips that really can help support you in the early weeks. So if you are going through this, there's so much help available. Don't forget, in my book, it's not just me. There are lots of other leading experts offering information as well. So, you know, it's not just my take on what to eat. Anyways, talking about the fact that stuff comes up for you, and things need to be reintegrated, and we have to start, you know, growing as people once we ditch the booze. We have a Family Constellations workshop on March the 27th. I've tried to describe it. I find it very difficult, but have a look at some of the testimonials. Feel free to ask me any questions you want. It's kind of one of those things where you have to say, you just have to experience the magic. One of our attendees from the last one just said, I think it's a must now for anyone who wants peace and health and happiness in their life. It was just the best day ever. So that was a really nice testimonial. So check it out. It's in Hertfordshire with a leading trauma expert, as well as myself, on Sunday, 27th of March. And ahead of that, we've got a really lovely, 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 lovely meditation and sound healing afternoon. That's on Sunday the 6th. And I've got some Champneys dates as well for self-care and sobriety. So there's a bunch of stuff going on. There's also going to be an event with our Sober Club Scotland contingent. So I've forgotten the date. I think it's the 26th of February. So if you're in Scotland and you might want to join in on that, then make sure you go to thesoberclub.com. Click on events and we'll make sure you get information there. I'm going to make it up there at some point, but I don't know if it will be for this one. So, but it'd be great to be able to get those Scottish members and Scottish people together. Today's guest, I just love chatting to Lee Davey. We've done lots of podcasts together. We always end up going off on some wild tangents. And Lee has got his book out. It's really good. It's very dip-in-able, very, very bite-sized bits of nuggets of wisdom. So very easy to read. And so, of course, great opportunity to chat. Enjoy the interview. I'm so delighted to speak to Lee Davey. Hi, Lee. How are you?
Hi, I am great. I'm going to start by reading a text message I got this morning, just to prove I'm not lying. Oh, I better not do that, because the person will see the name. Look, this is a message I got this morning. Hi, Lee. Great to hear from you. I won't hesitate to recommend you. Looking forward to your next conversation with Janie Lee Grace. They are always, in capital letters, her best episode.
Oh,
fact.
Brilliant. Oh, that's so funny.
That was this morning.
Oh, it's so great to chat to you. It's really great. I know, I love our conversations. You always end up making me laugh for hours on end. I've had a couple of really difficult interviews in the last couple of days, so this will hopefully be a bit more fun. But not least, because we're talking about your book. And that's super exciting. So I was very grateful when you came on the podcast and interviewed me about my book. gave me a chance to talk about my own book. And you finally got the book out. And I'm so pleased, because, you know, you've had your Strive method forever and a day, and you've been doing the work you do forever and a day. And you've totally nailed this area of quitting the booze. And so absolutely makes sense to write the book, right? What took you so long?
What took me so long? Honestly, scared.
Really? Oh, come on. We've spoken about this, haven't we? I know it's the same for everyone, but that getting your message out there thing and having to actually step into the spotlight can be tough, can't it?
Yeah, it was just fear, to be honest. I really, I really didn't want to write another Alan Carr book. I see a lot of books that are written kind of saying, I really didn't want to do that. And I felt that his book was so good. Yeah. And then I was just afraid that I was going to write something. Everyone was going to say that it was wank, but
there probably will be a couple of people who will. It's the way it goes.
Without a doubt.
We've all had that, right?
I've grown up a little bit now, and it's not about me, is it? It's about trying to get as many people to think differently about alcohol. That's what the book is about, really. Exactly. It's about, I want people to read it and go, oh, I never thought of that. I don't think they're going to read it and suddenly not drink or anything like that. It's just, I just want them to think differently, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, both you and I know that reading, you know, just how life-changing books can be. A book just has to land at the right time. And it literally is everything. It changes everything. Yeah. You know, I absolutely credit my sobriety to a book. You know, it landed at the right time. And, you know, if our books can do that for one person, then it's job done, isn't it, really?
What I found since, like you said, I've been doing this a long time now, and it's really interesting, you know, watching how people like to learn. And without a doubt, in the vast majority of cases, people want to stop drinking alcohol by taking a pill. You can have the best online courses infrastructure in the world. They won't watch the videos. You can have the greatest community in the world. They won't come on and share and be vulnerable. So a book is like the cheapest and the easiest way for somebody to learn more about it, because they can just spend 5 or 10 minutes every now and then having a read.
Well, that's what I really like about it. We should say, by the way, it's called The Strive Method: Control Alcohol in 30 Days. So it doesn't control you for 30 years. Have I got the strap line right?
Yeah, you are.
No, I love it. And that's perfect. That's exactly right. But I love the way you've laid it out, actually. I haven't had a chance to read every word, but I've done a good skim through. And I think you've made it very sort of dip-in-able. And that's what I really like about it. So you really can pick out a section and sort of read that little bit and just get that. And there's a lot of little light bulbs in there where you just think, oh God, yeah, you know, that's absolutely right. I mean, just to get into a few little bits, you know, you obviously talk about the stuck phase, which of course is where so many people are at, you know, it's where I was at for bloody years, you know, on, off, on, off. And it's those really important questions, you know, why do I drink and why can't I stop?
Mm. Yeah.
So deliver me the answers.
I mean, they're super important. Like this is a question I get thrown at me a lot, is it goes a little bit something like this. So Lee, tell me, this alcohol thing, was you addicted? And I always answer it by saying, well, my definition of addiction is probably different to a lot of other people's, right? Like a lot of people will look up the clinical definition of addiction and try to separate it from habit. I just simply say, look, if you try to stop drinking alcohol, you just try to stop and you find it incredibly difficult, right? For whatever reason, you can't say, look, I don't have a problem with alcohol, but I want to drink it because I want to be around my friends. No. That is a problem that you need to drink to be around your friends, and you're finding it difficult to stop. Once you're in that territory, I know this will rub people up the wrong way, I think you're addicted to alcohol because you need it. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that realization, for me anyway, was enough for me to go, holy cow, I don't like this. Because, you know, I don't like being controlled.
Yeah, exactly.
By anybody, especially an invisible, violent, and dominant belief system, which is, you know, ubiquitous around the world.
Yeah.
Outside of certain cultures, like you're not going to go to Saudi Arabia and find this problem, right? But in the most cultures, there's a big issue here, right?
No, absolutely. And, you know, I think that, I think you're right that this is an addiction. I mean, it's a conversation that we don't need to get into for the purposes of today. But of course, that doesn't necessarily mean, because you have that addiction, that you are an alcoholic who can never be free from that.
No, but because the system, which I call the system alcoholism, right? So for everyone listening, you know, the biggest wake up call for me, which really helped me to stop drinking, was to understand that if alcohol kills 3.3 million people in the world globally, more than war, murder, and terrorism combined, if it's a causal factor in over 200 illnesses and diseases, if it's one of the top five most addictive drugs in the world, right? If it's all of those things, why, if we was to play Family Fortunes and go out to the town center and ask 100 people what you like to do in your spare time, most people would say, drink the same stuff. So for me, it was a question of, hang on a minute, they don't go together. We have a clear demarcation that drugs like heroin, for example,
we
have a clear demarcation. But and we actually have that with smoking as well, to a certain degree. We still sell them, but we have that to a certain degree. But alcohol is very different. It's that, like we've said this before, it's the only drug which you're encouraged to take by your parents when you're a child.
Exactly.
And you are actually ostracized and ridiculed when you don't. So when I looked at that and thought about that, I realized that actually from the moment you're born, you are indoctrinated into a system which is invisible because it doesn't have a name. It's violent because it kills so many people, and you just have to go down the high street and see the carnage. And it's dominant because most people drink, right? I think the World Health Organization, in the latest report I read, was like 52% of people in the world like drink, right? Of the people who they reviewed. So it's invisible because it doesn't have a name. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to name this thing. This thing is called alcoholism. And that is basically the structure of the book, is like, how does this system work, right? How does it work? So that's why I created the Strive Method. And STUCK is like the first phase of the six-phase Strive Method. That's where, when you're asking yourself, well, why do I drink and why can't I stop? It's where you start to get a little bit interested in this system and learning a little bit about it, you know?
Mm, yeah, absolutely. And obviously don't need to go through everything, obviously, because we want people to get the book, but just picking up on, you know, a few of your sections. I mean, actually, I, of course, I'm always queen of wanting to get to the positive bit. So, you know, when we've gone past your, you know, the kind of recovery bit, I love the way when you get to your evolution. I know I'm fast forwarding them. I'm happy for you to come back as it were. But you got a fabulous phrase about evolution, about this is where you can build rockets and fly to the moon or something like that, which is
fly to Mars.
It's just perfect. It absolutely sums up exactly what it is like when you finally get freedom from the goddamn alcohol trap. You actually can build rockets and fly to Mars.
Well, Michael Bajarski, he's one of our strivers, one of our community members. He has an online t-shirt store. I haven't worn it today, but I should have worn it. He created a t-shirt and it says the Strive Method, and there's a Mars and a rocket ship. And he says, we build rockets and fly to Mars. That's really important, because the work that we do at Strive now, we're actually focusing more on Strive, a life after alcohol. So what we're going to do, Janie, is we're going to let other people help people to stop. Although we know we're going to catch a lot of people anyway, you know, in that area, but we're going to focus on, hey, if you've been yo-yoing between stopping and not stopping, or you've stopped and you want to build a rocket and fly to Mars,
exactly,
come to us and we'll help you do that. Because for me, there was two things that happened in my life. One, I stopped drinking, and that lifted me out of the matrix, so to speak. Right. So that was great. But boy, did I think I had all the answers and that I was so smart and clever. And it took me 10 years to really then do the deeper work around inner child work, trauma, meaning and purpose, how I'm showing up as a husband, as a man. So you can miss all that when you're sober. So it's the evolution part of it is the most exciting part of the Strive Method for me. It really is.
Yeah. And it is so interesting, isn't it? When we, you know, when we do finally do this, and I mean, depending on what age you are, you kind of realize, my God, that all the big stuff has been through the haze of booze. And really do have to learn to get good at managing emotions and just everything. Everything has to come in through new eyes, doesn't it? That's why the first year it can be is so critical, really.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrifying. You know, it's like my boy is 21 today, and I've just been going through Google.
Happy birthday, Dad!
I've just been going through Google Photos. You know, looking to get a lot of images of ourselves out there, and you know, remembering for the first 10 years of his life, being drunk at virtually every one of his birthday parties. Like we had to organize a birthday party that was somehow near a bar, or we had alcohol around the house. And I've often spoken to him, you know, about this, and he's like, Dad, you know, like I had a great childhood. I thought he was a great dad. And I always say to him, yeah, but I could have been so much more. You don't know, like I could have been so much more present. I could have been so much more there for you. But he's like super proud of what I'm doing. And when we get together, that the fact that he doesn't have to drink, right?
Exactly. So
he can just leave it and just be okay with his dad. Or if he wants to, he can just have a few. He doesn't have that peer pressure, right?
So yeah, it's so true. So many of us feel, I mean, that really is my biggest regret, that I didn't do this sooner, you know, that I could have been present for the kids when they were young. And it's like, oh God, you know, but you can't live your life going back, can you? You can only be grateful for what you have now. And also, as you say, you know, your kid's good with it. And I do think, you know, I know I've told you that I'm doing a lot of work with family constellations at the moment, hosting workshops and stuff. And that's such humbling work. But the minute these issues come up, you start to think to yourself, oh my God, what have I done to my kids? What the hell? But you have to just constantly remember that the more work you do, the less they have to do. It doesn't mean that you can go back and erase the time when it was shit, because you can't, you know.
No.
But you can own it, you can absolutely own it. And if they can see that, you know, the path you trod and came through and were actually, even as you say, willing to put your hands up and apologize, then it makes all the difference in the world. You know, it really does.
It's all about trust, right? Like every relationship is built on trust and security. And if you don't have trust and security in your relationships, you've had it. So for me, you know, with Jude, it's just about creating a container where he trusts me and he feels secure. And then if that's okay, then we don't have to worry about the past. We just, in the moment, we just create a really good present.
Yeah.
You know, and we at Strive, like we call ourselves lineage breakers, right? Because we literally like, okay, so Jude is 21. I have a 5-year-old, Zia. Zia, when she has children, will be completely different in the way that she approaches life, the way that she is emotionally more intelligent, the way she thinks about life, her attitude towards drinking alcohol, taking drugs, etc. I really do believe that the greatest thing that we can do in our late 40s and 50s and 60s is to just be a role model for those who look up to us and go, oh, wow, I honestly don't need to get drunk because my dad doesn't and he's pretty cool.
Absolutely. So let's dig back a bit. We've been to the end. Pick out a couple of bits for me and just share your, you know, let's just roll with a couple of things I've got it online, but I don't know if I've got it to hand here. Hold on,
let's have a look. I think
you're telling me you haven't got your own book on your lap as we talk. Here we go.
I haven't got a physical copy.
So, well, let's talk about rupture and repair, because
you talk about
boundaries. I like that. And then you talk about rupture and repair. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so for me, one of the key reasons that people drink alcohol is they just cannot relate effectively and compassionately and in a loving way with the most important people in their life, right? So if we take a primary relationship of a man and another man, or a woman and another woman, or a man and another woman, but for this case we'll just stick with heterosexual, right? So you got a man and a woman, right? A husband and a wife, and they just cannot get on. the wife has all her shit and all her inner child stuff and all her trauma and all her stories. He has all his. And over time, the relationship gets stale. They are not communicating very effectively at all. And then they stop drinking alcohol, right? And then now there's a wonderful opportunity to fix that because you are now more present. You're almost kind of like forced into it, right? It's like, okay, like I'm not drinking. What am I going to do with my time here? So rupture and repair to me, what came from me realizing that I wanted to be the best husband that I could be. And so I went on this voyage of self-discovery, taking training courses, learning about how to improve my relational literacy, all this kind of jazz. But I kept screwing up. And the reason I kept screwing up was I was hardwired that certain parts of my psyche would be triggered when Liza behaved in certain ways. She would remind me of my mom, or she would remind me of my dad. And I was on the border of my window of tolerance, and I would just fly into sympathetic nervous system state, Hulk brain, and I would lose my shit. And then I would find myself afterwards going, you've done it again. You're no good, Lee. You cannot do this. What's the matter with you? And at the same time, Liza's going, I see, I can't trust you. You're full of shit. You say you're not going to do it again, and you're still shouting at me. And then I realized, hang on, Lee, you're not doing this wrong. You're actually doing exactly what you should be doing, but you're focusing too much on trying to get it right first time. You're focusing on, I've got to get my lines right. And if I don't get my lines right, I'm screwed. What you need to do is be more effective at repairing your screw ups, right? So give yourself compassion that, hey, you are an imperfect human being. And you are very angry because you've got all these little inner child parts of you. And when Liza or someone else flips it, you're going to shout at them, right? Be okay with that. All right. But then fix it. Realize that you screwed up. Analyze the situation from outside of yourself, so to speak. See what you could have done wrong. Look at things from their perspective. Take 100% responsibility. Get out of victim consciousness. Don't think that you're a victim and they're a villain. Get out of that. And then go to them and say, hey, yesterday when I shouted at you, I imagine that that really, really hurt. And I imagine it really pissed you off. I imagine your trust in me slipped a little bit and hope in our relationship because I keep telling you that I am going to change. And I imagine it really confuses you. And I need you to know that I feel terrible. I feel embarrassed, a little bit ashamed that I can't nail this, but I love you and I'm sorry and I'm committed to getting this right. Now, once I started doing that, what happened was in my relationship with Liza and my kids and everybody else, the stores of hope in our relationship started to grow, build. And then what was happening was, it was almost like you was getting a get out of jail free card. You was now allowed to screw up because your wife knew that the next thing that was going to happen after you screwed up is you were actually going to take ownership. And the amount of my clients, when I've taught them this, do you know that the when they just go to their women, and because I work with men a lot, they go to their women and they apologize and they own up. The thing that is always said is the woman says, that's all I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
They don't want you to change everything about your life. They just want you to stop gaslighting, stop thinking they're insane, and for you to own your shit, right? Mm. That's all they want. And they're just like, I've just been waiting you for say that for 20 years. Thank you.
Yeah.
And everything
it takes
changes. So that's
courage though, doesn't it? It takes such courage. And you know that the one, I mean, we start this part of our chat with you saying when, you know, these two people, they stop drinking. But of course, in many cases, it will be partner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and that is where the trouble starts. And I've got, you know, I've got clients who they'll be like, there's one woman who has a partner, but she doesn't live with the partner. So she's made a decision. She's not drinking, all good. The second she gets with the partner,
all the old self-sabotage comes in and she just can't find that strength in that new, in that different situation. And that's where it really gets difficult, because we end up becoming people pleasers sometimes. We don't even want to drink. We just bloody do it to make someone else feel better. What the hell is that about? You know, and so many of us have been through that. It's just the easiest option to make someone else feel better, because we don't feel strong enough to be able to own our own, you know, our own stuff and set the right boundaries.
Yeah, it's that we're not used to in a case like that where you really don't want to drink, and then your partner's, come on, you've done really well. Exactly. You've gone 7 days without, just have one with me, right? You know, the way that I guide our community through situations like that, because we get it a lot, is we're always trying to come from a place of compassion, right? You know. Actually, I'll give you a different story. It's not about alcohol, but it's the same kind of theme, right? Mm. So one of our strivers, Liz, she was doing a assignment in the Strive method called Stigma. And she was writing about how stigma of being someone who doesn't drink alcohol is not hitting her life right now, but a stigma of being unvaccinated is hitting her right now. And she told me a story about how a teacher in Scotland said to the children, stand up if you've been vaccinated. And all these kids stood up. And he says, well done, you'd make it a world a safe place. And then the teacher said, stand up those of you who are unvaccinated. And her son stood up and a few others. And he was like, shame on you, right? So she was writing about how that's really wrong and really bad, right? And so I was then saying to Liz, okay, so we're talking about this guy stigmatizing the non-vaccinated. But we got to be careful that when we deal with this, we don't slip into victim consciousness ourselves, right? And become victims. Because what I'm reading in your homework assignment is that's what's happening. And now we're making him out to be a villain. So if we make him out to be a villain, we have to be a victim, which means we're in victim consciousness as well. So what's the way out of that, right? And this is very similar when we're looking at someone who's wants us to drink alcohol. We look at them as a villain and we become a victim. It's victim consciousness. So how do you get out of that? Simply in this case with this guy is to ask ourselves, what is going on for this guy? Mm. Now, I don't need to read his mind, but I can have a good guess that he's probably afraid that he doesn't have a mental map of the world where COVID exists. He doesn't have a mental map of what on earth happens when some people are vaccinated, some people aren't. And there's this thing that could kill him or kill people he loves, and he's scared. So because he's scared, he shames little kids. Now, we might look at that and go, shame on him. And he is not right what he does, right? It's the way that he behaves is not right. But understanding why he does it allows us to climb out of victim consciousness and look at this human being and say, okay, he's really scared. And he doesn't know how to deal with this. And he's doing it in the best way his inner child thinks is right. Similarly, when someone is trying to get you to drink, they're just scared.
Yeah, they don't know
how to handle you. They might be worried that you are calling yourself an alcoholic and they don't want you to hurt yourself. So they're saying to drink to try to protect you. Mm. And all the time we're getting really angry at them.
Yeah. You know? It is interesting how our decisions can threaten other people or seemingly threaten them. It is true. It is true. Yeah. You also have a section called the Conversations with God. Tell us about that.
Conversations with God. Okay. So Conversations with God. This is basically about indoctrination, right? So God, we're talking about some really tough subjects here. So basically what I say in the book is I have a daughter, Zia. She's 5 and she is currently in California with her mom. I'm in Latvia. It's another story altogether. But every Sunday, she goes to a Christian church called the All Nations Church. It's called the All Nations Church, but everyone's Korean. So she goes to this, church. And we pick her up and I'm like, how did it go, Zia? And she's like, yeah, it's really cool. God is great. God is light. God is everything. Everything is God, right? And I realize that as somebody who doesn't believe in a biblical God, and my wife doesn't believe in a biblical God, we suddenly realize that our daughter at 5 years of age believes in a biblical God, right? Why? She believes in it because the vast majority of her peers who are teaching her about this thing are teaching her one way, right? They're teaching her that there is a God. And there's no room in that conversation for her to say, no, there isn't, or anything like that. And this is different than Santa Claus, because at some point in the future, someone in her school playground will likely say, there ain't no Santa Claus. And then she'll come home to us and we'll say, no, there ain't no Santa Claus. With God, it's very different. She is likely going to go to a school where Christianity is going to, like right now, she's in a school of Christianity, right? I don't know what she's going to do in the future, but right now she is. So all of her teachers and all of her kids, they all believe in God. So she's going to grow up believing in God. Okay, so what choice did she have, right? Like, did she have a choice? Like, we haven't taken her to any kind of like mosques. We haven't talked to her about Buddhism yet. We haven't talked to her about Muslims, right? We will at some point in time. But right now, she's not really getting a choice. She will get to a certain age, and this belief that God exists will be what I call a foundational belief.
Yeah.
And it will be really difficult to shift it. And the reason I talk about that is it really is no different than when we become people who drink alcohol. It's the same bloody thing. If you was to grab most people and start having a conversation around alcohol, they would find it very difficult to change their beliefs, because drinking alcohol and viewing alcohol as a good, positive thing is a foundational belief.
Well, yeah, except that it's a good, positive thing until it's not. But those spectrums are seen as being so wide apart. So it's all good and it's all marvelous. Oh, apart from the few people, you know, the saddos that can't hold their beer.
Yeah,
which I'm not one. I'm all good, or whatever it is. That people never see this big spectrum, do they? They only ever see the, oh, it's all marvelous, or, oh, poor you, you saddo, you've got it bad.
Or they, you know, you've got the instances where you see your parents and they get drunk and they fight.
Yeah.
But then at the same time you see that, you've got this incredible peer pressure to conform or be isolated, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you don't follow the tribe and believe in God, with alcohol being God in this case, right, then your only other option is to be isolated and alone. Now, I'm 48. I'm in Latvia. I haven't seen my family for 2 months. I'm likely not going to see him for another couple of months. I've been struggling.
Yeah.
Like mentally, I've been struggling. Like I've really had to like do my yoga, do my EFT, do my mantras, do my meditations, look after myself, because I feel lonely. And I recognize that when I feel lonely, it's because my self-esteem's faltering a little bit and I'm not loving myself enough, right? So at 48, if I'm thinking that, what hope do you have when you're a 10, 11-year-old boy?
Yeah.
When people are trying to shove a Jagermeister shot in your hand and your dad's asking you to drink Baileys or have a, I don't know, do they do baby sham these days? I don't know. You are programmed as a young boy. I'm just going to pick on the masculine for a minute. You're programmed for a young boy to want to be a man as quickly as you can.
Mm.
As quickly as you can. So why aren't you not going to drink?
Yeah.
Your dad has probably raised you your entire life to your foundational belief system is it is hard as nails to drink alcohol. Mm.
And also, you know, that everyone does it. And like, why would you not? Is how it's seen. As I've heard you say before, you know, it's that rite of passage thing. You know, of course, if you're 16 or whatever, or if your 18th birthday, of course how could you possibly consider having any kind of a party or gathering that didn't involve alcohol? You know, my kids have said this to me. It's such a difficult one, isn't it? Until the scales come off and you can bloody see it for what it really is.
There's a big rise at the moment in men's groups where men are leading other men through healthy rites of passage. I was on a seminar the other day called The Illuminated Man, and there was a speaker on there. He was amazing. And he gets people, he takes them to nature in Arizona, and it's called a Vision Quest.
Oh yeah,
and
he just lets them go. Wilderness. Yeah,
he just leaves.
Yeah.
There's bears and there's lions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Just crack on with it, love.
You know, and his view is like, this is what they used to do.
Yeah.
This is what the tribes
absolutely
used to do.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Not drink a load of alcohol and get yourself shit faced and end up in ER.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You know, that's not what they used to do. There needs to be more healthy ritualization.
Definitely.
For men to bring young boys through and for women to bring young girls through.
I have heard of a place, you know, in the UK where it's there's like some woodland thing where a guy can take his son when he's 13 and do exactly that kind of process. How amazing would that be?
Well, I got to be honest, I'm a bit of a shithouse. I would rather do that in the UK than go to California.
Oh, yeah, there is that.
With a
bear. We don't want bears, right?
I was well into it. I'm like, I'm going to do this.
Being sober makes you brave, but not that brave.
Dude, I was driving through California not long ago before I come out of Latvia, and a lion ran across the street where I live, you know?
Oh, my God. I remember going to Yosemite, and they really wind you up that you have to take every tiny bit of food out of your car, because if you don't, the bears just, like, come along and break the door of the car to, like, nick you half an apple or something.
Yeah, I don't.
I know how we got
onto
bears. Anyway.
Well, that's another reason not to get drunk.
Well, absolutely.
so you don't get buggered by a bear.
Yeah, exactly. Tell us about your section, The Profound Mirror.
The Profound Mirror. This one, in essence, is really beautiful. And if everybody in the world could practice this, we wouldn't have any problems. The person that I fight with the most is obviously my wife. I think that's pretty much going to be there for most people. Like your mum or your dad might come into it, whatever. But when my wife, one of the things that I have with the story that I have with my wife is that she tries to control me all the time, right? And I actually had a beautiful message off her this morning, because she's obviously having to look after Zia on her own, you know? And let me read this message out to you, actually, because I thought it was really beautiful. And this is kind of like what we're talking about. So let me find this message. Give me a second there. Can't get my freaking phone to work. All right, where are you, Liza? Well, I send a lot of messages out. Here we go. So send me this message. Just want you to know, I woke up to this morning and started crying. Just want you to know how grateful I am for all the amazing work you put in with Zia. I never realized how much work it is. And on top of that, you dealt with all my criticizing. I can see how controlling I was. And I'm so sorry for all that I put you through. You deserve to be rewarded, not punished. I love you so much.
Oh, that's
lovely. And I woke up to that this morning. It's beautiful, right? So there's this story, right, that she controls me too much. And here's my wife said, yeah, I kind of do. But let's ignore that a minute. So if I keep thinking she's controlling me all the time, I'm a victim again, right? And she's a villain, which is already back in that victim consciousness. But the profound mirror is when you're saying to yourself, wow, she's such a controlling bitch. I cannot believe how much she controls me. Is then to ask yourself, where's this projection? Where am I trying to control everything? And holy shit, when you ask yourself that question, you can see how you yourself are an absolute control freak. Like, you are such a control freak. And because you're trying to control everything, and you know that that's a shadow side of you, an inner child of you that is trying to control everything, you don't like it. You don't want to admit it. So when you see somebody else behaving in the way that you behave at your worst, you go at them.
Yeah.
How dare you control me, right? You should not do that. And it's a way of deflecting away from the fact you're doing the same thing yourself.
Yeah.
Another good example around the profound mirror is hate. Whenever you hate somebody or you really adore somebody, right? You probably hate somebody because they're doing something that is really, really winding, really, like, ethically so wrong for you. But when you ask yourself, you've done that or you are doing that. It may not be exactly the same, but the same ethical boundary is being breached. And that's why you're hating them, because you're hating yourself, but you're putting it out on them. And then the adoration side of that is you look at Janie Lee and you think, wow, she's got an amazing podcast. She was a pop star. She wrote loads of books. She's such a creative genius. I adore her so much. The profound mirror there is, there's a creative genius within me that I won't let out because I'm afraid. I will adore you. Mm. And those realizing and understanding the profound mirror really helps you to get underneath, why am I drinking? Right? Like, why am I drinking? Yeah. So that's,
I think having to kind of look at the shadow side is really tough for all of us, you know, and I'm sure we've had this discussion before, but I know that for some people, this sort of knowledge, even though it might be a little bit subconscious, that once they stop drinking, they're going to have to look at some shit. Right.
Yeah.
That's tough, isn't it? Because, you know, I know people who they'll just put it off and put it off because there's this kind of underlying thing. Well, you know, there's a hell of a lot of shit piling up here. And when you really do stop numbing out, well, you know, it's going to hit the fan. You're going to have to look at it. Now, of course, now we know that actually, yeah, you do have to look at it. The good news is you become a bit more resilient and you certainly have a lot more clarity and you can look at it through different eyes. But when you're stuck in that place of still drinking and all you can see ahead of you is the kind of fear that once you've stopped, you're going to have to deal with a hell of a lot more than you already are. You know, this is why for me, you can't, it's so difficult to do this unless you go in with this with the positivity, unless you can catch sight of that, you know, as you say, building rockets and flying to Mars, unless you can catch sight of the better life. I don't know how people do this. I think the other way around that people try and do it, the sort of, oh my God, I've got to, otherwise, you know, husband will leave me, this will happen or I'll die. I mean, I understand that there's part of it, that, of course. But if that's all it is, I don't know how you can be, you need the motivation to drive you, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think there's like two camps, isn't there? There's the people who want to stop drinking and that's it. They don't want any other aspect of their life to change. They're afraid of change, but they just want to stop drinking. And then there's those who want a better life, but drinking's in the way. That's what we're really talking about here is like all that shadow work. That's all about living a better life.
Yeah.
Like
true.
Getting to know really who you are, you know, and I might be a bit weird because I love it. Like, I've never had a problem with it. I love looking there, going there, sharing it with people. The hardest part of it for me is in that rupture and repair phase where let's say I'm in a fight with Liza. I say something to her and she turns around and she says, "You fucking hypocrite. You hypocrite. You called me out on that and you are doing the same thing right now." The hardest part for me is to go, "Yeah, I am."
Yeah.
"And I did. And I'm so sorry." And then afterwards asking yourself, where did that come from? Why did I want to protect myself so much? Or what I usually do is, "No, I'm not. I'm not an hypocrite. You're talking shit," and then try to justify why you said what you said. And then afterwards go back and say, "You were right. I was wrong. I was a hypocrite." But then you've got to ask yourself, why am I behaving like this? Why am I justifying? Why am I shouting? Why am I making her a villain? Like, my job is to protect my wife or my kids, why am I actually the scariest guy in the room? If you used to ask Liza, who's the person you're afraid of the most? It's me. And I'm supposed to be protecting her. Like, in order to answer those questions, you've really got to. Here's the thing. And this is everyone. I really all want to list this. Janie Lee has an amazing community. I have an amazing community. Annie Grace has an amazing community. AA has their amazing community, right? You cannot do this alone. It is so scary to turn around and say to somebody, I was raped when I was younger, or I molested somebody when I was younger, or I think something happened to me, or I punched a kid in the face and stole his lunch money. These things, there's so much shame around these things that we hide it and we stuff it down and we're not allowed to emote and we're emotional beings. And that is one of the reasons why we drink or we take drugs or we watch pornography or we gamble or we sit down eating ice cream, watching Netflix, whatever it is, we deaden ourselves because we can't face it. But I am here to tell you that if you surround yourself with the right people, if you were here now having a conversation with me and Janie, and you said to me, Lee, when I was younger, I did something sexually that I'm really super ashamed that I did, I would be like, dude, so did I. So did a million other people.
There's that fantastic line.
Tell me more.
That fantastic line in Catherine Gray's book. Was it in Catherine Gray's book? It's one of the funniest lines ever, where she said something like, oh, God, I'm not going to be able to raise on that awful when people come out with a joke.
I can't remember it.
It's something along the lines of, you know, everyone thinks they got the worst story ever, right? And it's just something like, and, you know, and somebody writes to me and says, I don't know how I'm going to tell you this. I shagged a zebra. And she goes, well, I shagged two. It just slipped in as this one tiny little line. Yeah. I've just accredited it to Catherine Gray. It might not be her. Anyway,
it's
absolutely right. And the shame, seriously, the shame that we carry. It's absolutely true. And then what we do is we push this down, whatever it is, big or small. And then we add to that all of the limiting beliefs, all of the stuff that we've been told. You know, you stand up to try and say something at school and you're told, shut up, sit down, you're not worth it. You know, and that goes in and the work I've been doing lately, it's really made me realize that we've all got trauma, whether that's your big T stuff or your little T stuff, and they're equally as important. Because I used to think that I was lucky, in inverted commas, that okay, I hadn't been abused as a child, therefore why the hell would I end up turning to drink? What hell excuse had I got? And it's only now I realize that I had one after the other, potentially hundreds of little traumas, many of them. And it's not the trauma, it's what you make it mean. And when you've made it mean, I'm not wanted, I shouldn't speak up, I shouldn't be seen, I'm not, whatever, then that stays with you. And those formative years, it's what you make it mean.
Yeah, you have to remember, when you're thinking about this as an adult, you have to remember that you might think now, yeah, that wasn't traumatic, but you're 48.
Exactly.
The 6-year-old, it was traumatic for them.
Yeah. And in that moment, you made a decision, so-and-so doesn't love me because I'm not lovable. At that age, you're not able to kind of go, oh, hey, the parents are drinking and fighting and everything's shit. And that's because they're drinking too much. And you don't rationalize all of that.
No,
it's just,
I'll share an example. One of my clients, right? We were doing some work the other day. There was a part of her that was getting triggered by her mother. And we did some work. And she realized that when she was younger, she had this memory when she was younger where her father and her were subjected to an armed mugging, right? And she was only very young, maybe 3 or 4. And in that moment, she created a rule that she was there to protect her parents and be responsible for her parents' safety. And now she's finding herself in her 40s. And she's freaking the fuck out because she feels like she has to look after her mom.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the 3-year-old created that rule.
Yeah.
Like, what release to be able to then do some work to allow it to meet that three-year-old.
Absolutely.
To say to the three-year-old, look,
not your responsibility.
It's not your responsibility. Let it go. Do you want to let it go? These parts want to let it go. They don't want to.
Exactly.
They don't want to keep onto it.
Yeah. So true. Wow, we could talk forever, Lee. Is there anything else you want to tell us and any other little gems from the book you want to pick out on before we give all your details?
You know, I made it short and sweet. So each chapter is pretty short. I think the boundaries one is a little bit longer. But I think about my own reading, you know, like I just like to read for like, I read like 6 books a night, 10 minutes a time, right? So
Oh, really?
I get bored if I read one book.
So
Are
you suffering from that lovely word, Sunduko? T-Z-U-N-D-U-K-O. Japanese word for having way more books than you'll ever read.
Oh, yeah.
Have you got that illness?
Definitely.
So you actually read 6 books? A bit of each?
Actually, now I'm in Latvia on my own, I'm probably reading more. So I'm...
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you not get a bit confused that you can't keep a thread?
No. Well, this is why I always choose books that I can literally get a chapter done in like 10 minutes.
Right.
So that's why I read the book, you know. The other thing is this next steps at the end of his book. And it's a shame because I'm assuming most people won't do them. But if they did, it would really change their life, you know. And the last thing I wanted to say is, it's really, I wrote the book because I want people to come into community.
Yeah.
Like I want them to come into this. I want them to read the book and say, oh, this guy knows what he's on about. I trust that he knows what he's on about. I'm going to give this a shot and go into the Strive method and start working on building my rockets and flying to Mars, right? Or you read the book and you're like, yeah, I don't want to go into these community. I want to go into Janie's, or I want to go into AA or something else. Reading a book alone is great, but you don't have to. I'm actually doing monthly book clubs. So I'm emailing anybody who's got a copy of the book and inviting them to a monthly book club where I will read a chapter and then open that up to a deeper dive into that chat, a little bit like we've done today. So allows people to do that as well. So yeah,
brilliant. So just remind us where we can find obviously the best place to get the book and find more information.
It's on Amazon, but the best place to get the book is just to go to www.1000daysober.com. That's 1000 with a thousand, right? So go there. And the reason is the best place to go there, because if you go there and get the book, you'll end up on my email list and you'll be able to get a lot more value out of it. And like anybody else, if you think I'm just peddling you a load of shit, you just unsubscribe, right? but I like to think that I put a lot of value out there. So go there, get the book. We got the online book clubs, which you'll be a part of. Again, if you go to Amazon, I won't know you got the book, so you won't be a part of that. So we've got that as well. And most importantly, if you read it and you like it, send me a testimonial, but give it to somebody else.
Exactly.
I'll tell somebody else to read it. Yeah.
Yeah. Pass it on. Brilliant. Well, I wish you every success with it. It's Thank great. You. I love it. It's very, very readable, very dip-in-able. I mean, even I could like have it on the go and have another one.
Yeah, there you go.
See, I'd be stepping massively out of my comfort zone, but I might do it for you.
yeah, there you go.
So yeah, cool. Anyways, we're gonna get to meet. Hey, how exciting is that?
Yes.
I'm about it forever. Let's do it.
I'm coming into the UK next week. So yeah, we're gonna do
Fantastic.
That.
Brilliantly, all the best and big congratulations on the book and look forward to seeing what other magic you create in due course. See you later.
Thank you.
So I've put those links in the show notes for you for Lee Davey. Hopefully we'll get to do something together at some point. Love to do that. Just a reminder of our events. And if you go to thesoberclub.com, click on events. And obviously, if you want to join us as a member, you know, join our community. There's so much content there. There's so much connection. Whatever you do, as Lee said, it doesn't really matter which path you choose. There are so many different groups and support available to you, and lots of different things work for different people, but always, always, always reach out and get support. Don't try and do this on your own. You know, when people hole up and try and do it on their own, that's when it goes bad. It's bound to, right? We need support. We really do need connection. And we need to be with people who've experienced what we want to experience. I think that sort of aspirational piece is really key. It's not just what you're not doing, it's what you're moving towards. And as you know, in the Sober Club, that really is what it's all about. It's, yes, of course I want you to ditch the booze, but I want you to carry on evolving, carry on growing, carry on just living your best life. As Lee says, you know, get to the point where you build in your rockets and fly to the moon. I love that. So anyways, always make sure that you follow me on social media, that you feel free to drop me a message if you know, if there's anything I can help with, or if you just want to tell somebody that you're doing this, because it's really important to tell somebody, then just follow me on social media at Genuinely Grace. You can always message me. Obviously, you can check out the Sober Club. If you're really struggling, if you want some real, in-depth support, then always check out Alcohol Change UK. They've got, you know, a lot of great resources on their website. Just don't suffer on your own. That's my message. You can tell it's on my mind. I've had a couple of messages this week from people who have kind of are admitting that they feel they can't do this thing. They feel it's too hard for them. So they're admitting that they're retreating. They're choosing to retreat. And it's just the worst possible thing. Just stay connected. In a community like the Sober Club, there is no judgment at all. People are just there to love and support each other. It really is like that. So always reach out. Whatever stage you're at, if you've been sober for years, then thank you for listening to this podcast. Thank you for, you know, being part of these discussions, because the more we keep ourselves inspired, the more we can shine our light, and that's going to reflect onto other people, right? You know, we're all dropping these little kind of balls of light towards everyone else. And that's got to be a good thing. You know, the tide is definitely turning, which is fantastic news. And I'll see you same time next week. Check out thesoberclub.com and have a quick look at those events, because some of them are coming up really soon and they are getting booked up fast, particularly our event on March the 6th and the Family Constellation. So yeah, check it out. I'll see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.